Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Deval Patrick made history by becoming the first African-American in the United States to be re-elected as governor. In a new memoir titled A Reason to Believe, he traces his improbable rise from a broken home on Chicago's South Side to the upper echelons of American politics. Today, he announces a new organization to educate Americans about the benefits of the new health care law. The Democratic governor from Massachusetts, Deval Patrick, joins me in the studio. We do invite your calls, questions. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to you,
Governor.
Good
morning, Diane. It's wonderful to be back. Nice to be with you.
Before we begin to talk about your own memoir, I'd be interested in your comments about President Obama's speech. Did it go far enough? Did he respond to his critics strongly enough? Or is there room for improvement?
Well, I didn't see the speech or hear it, but I did read it yesterday in between events, and I think it was a real leadership moment. I think what the president has done is elevate the conversation to what it is we are really debating, which is what kind of country we want to live in. I think that's what's underneath the debate around health care, around the question of the deficit and the debt. He has more patience than I do in many respects, to be lectured to about deficits and the size of government by the folks who who ran up the deficit to historic levels in the previous administration and the size of government.
Of course, they argue it was Democratic spending that took us up to these record levels.
You know, this is a matter of fact, not opinion. It was during the Bush administration that spending went out as far as the eye can see because we ran two wars on a credit card and we did an expensive drug benefit and didn't pay for it and we cut taxes at the same time. And that's not a matter of opinion. That's a matter of fact. But we're all in this. And so I do have some sympathy for the folks and the president chief among them who says enough already with how we got here, how are we going to go forward. And talking about the set of values around which we make those kinds of very difficult choices and leading around that is exactly, I think, where the president needs to be and where he was in his speech yesterday.
Tell me how health care reform authored by Governor Mitt Romney has worked in Massachusetts.
It's been a rousing success on so many levels. 98%+ of our residents have health insurance today. 99.8% of children. There's no other state in America that can touch that. More people are getting their care in less expensive primary care preventive settings than in emergency
rooms.
What
about the downside?
The only challenge we have faced is a challenge that's facing everybody, whether you have a universal system or not, and that's the fact that premiums go up too fast, too often. And I think just as because we've started some measures to try to deal with that and start being defeated by the complexity of it, we will be just as we were the model for national health care reform. I think we'll crack the code on cost containment. There's some really exciting things happening in Massachusetts around this right now. If you don't mind, Diane, I'd just love to tell you about a couple of them. First of all, last year or a year and a half ago, I took some steps through our insurance commissioner to use existing authority to cap excessive rate increases. This is not a permanent solution. It's not even a popular one, but it was something I did because small businesses and working families needed some relief. And it got the attention of the insurance companies. It brought them and the providers back to the table. We started then to move on something called payment reform, where we're going to look to pay for health insurance not by the amount of health insurance or the quantity of it, but the quality or outcome or value of it. And there's a rising consensus among the whole industry and patient advocates, the business community, and legislators as well, that that's the direction we ought to go in, and we can get some real savings.
And
there.
Moving on from health care to tax reform, President wants to raise taxes on upper-income earners as well as the corporate taxes. We heard in the last hour that that's going to hurt small business. How do you feel about that?
Well, look, you know, nobody wants their taxes raised. No one runs for office to raise taxes. I've cut the corporate tax and raised the sales tax since I've been in office. I don't think there's any one solution. And I think that the cartoon characters that we make of each other in politics around this issue are not helpful. I think that, you know, President Bush made a point when he was advocating for the tax cuts in the previous administration. He would always say, it's your money. And he's right. It is. But he didn't finish the thought because, see, it's also your broken roads and your overcrowded schools and your broken neighborhood and your broken neighbor, for that matter. And sooner or later, we're all going to have to start taking responsibility for that. And I think, frankly, that is what the president was getting at yesterday. The idea of simplifying the code and closing the loopholes and the exceptions and so forth so it is more transparent and accessible for normal people is important. The idea that we all have a contribution to make for the services we say we want is also important. And the conversation we ought to be having, and again, I think this is what the president is the leadership the president is showing, is what is it we want government to do and not do? And what does that actually cost? And then what is the most responsible way to share in doing that?
Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, his new memoir is titled A Reason to Believe: Lessons from an Improbable Life. Before we get to that phrase, an improbable life, why a memoir now?
Well, it's a great question because the agent I've been working with is someone I met about 15 years ago.
Who is that?
A wonderful young man named Todd Schuster from a firm in New York and Boston, and he's been after me to write this book for 15 years. And I have been, in fact, writing it in bits and pieces and talking about some of these stories and speeches and essays and so forth over the years and tucking them away in drawers. It's really I'm a very hopeful person. I'm an unrepentant idealist. And I've come to understand that hopefulness and idealism are strengths. They are real blessings. And the book is a gesture of gratitude to the many people, some of them known, some of them totally anonymous, who have given me those gifts, the teachers who gave me a reason to hope in a brighter future, the family members and some strangers who gave me a reason to believe in the power of kindness, the voters, for that matter, who've given me a reason to believe in the politics of conviction.
You and your elder sister.
Yes.
Rhonda, both raised by your mother, May Wintersmith, in a two-bedroom tenement owned by your maternal grandparents. Tell me about that life.
Well, we lived, we grew up on the south side of Chicago, most of that time on welfare. My mother and sister and I shared a two-bedroom tenement, as you said, with my grandparents and various cousins who came and went, and an uncle from time to time. My mother and sister shared one of those bedrooms and a set of bunk beds, Diane, so we go from the top bunk to the bottom bunk to the floor every third night on the floor. I went to big, broken, under-resourced, overcrowded, sometimes violent public schools. But I will say this, we had a community. In the 50s and the 60s, every child was under the jurisdiction of every single adult on the block.
Right.
Everybody was there. So if you messed up down the street in front of Ms. Jones, she'd straighten you out and then call home, right? So you get it two times. And I think what the adults were trying to get across to us was that they had a stake in us. That community is understanding the stake that each of us has, not just in our own dreams and our own struggles, but in our neighbors as well. And there was a lesson in that too.
I remember when you went to Milton Academy. Mm. How did you get there?
I got to Milton in 1970 through a scholarship through a program called A Better Chance, wonderful foundation that identifies minority kids, or as they used to say in the euphemism of the day, kids from non-traditional prep school backgrounds for independent schools. And I showed up. I was admitted to Milton and on scholarship.
Why were you admitted?
Well, I had three choices. Every student did in eighth grade in Chicago. You could go to the vocational school in your, and they were scattered around the city. They taught things I now wish I knew, like auto mechanics.
Exactly.
And
and
tailoring and things like
yeah.
that. But they weren't college preparatory. And although no one in my family had gone to college, I really wanted to go, and my family encouraged that ambition. I was very interested in architecture at the time. I still want to be an architect one day. And there were two technical schools in the city, one on the north side and one on the south side. And they taught mechanical drawing and things like that that seemed like they would be right for that ambition. But the better school was on the north side, and at the time they wouldn't take any south side students. I think they've been sued over that since. That's changed. And that left the general high school in our school district, which is actually, Diane, where we had our eighth grade classes. So I knew that environment well. And it was a great big building I describe in the book. No glass left in any of the windows because of the riots that had come through the south side in the summers before. So we had either plywood or plexiglass. Huge classrooms, a police officer at every intersection in the class and in the building. An eighth grade teacher, seventh grade teacher, introduced me to ABC, and then things started to change.
Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. Governor Deval Patrick of Massachusetts is here with me. If you've just joined us, he has a brand new book out. It's titled A Reason to Believe, Lessons from an Improbable Life. And it was, is, has been indeed an improbable life. There's a lovely story that you tell in the opening of the book. Would you read that for us,
sure,
please?
Once when I was 15, I had to catch a bus to meet a friend, and I was running late. I lived on the south side of Chicago near the corner of 54th Street and Wabash Avenue, so I raced south down Wabash past the white-walled commercial bakery that always smelled of sour yeast, across the weed-filled median on Garfield Boulevard, and east down a block past the liquor store, the laundromat, and the shop that sold live chickens to housewives. The shopkeeper could slaughter the bird, or the women could do it themselves at home. I reached the bus stop just as the familiar green and white CTA bus pulled up, oily and wheezing. I climbed the steps, reached for my coins, and only then realized that I did not have enough for the fare. The driver, a world-weary black man with a gray grizzle and salt-and-pepper mustache, had already jerked the bus into gear and started down the street. He gave me a withering look and told me gruffly to sit down, pointing to a seat close to the door. I obeyed. I braced myself for a stern lecture on the futility of trying to pull a fast one, and I assumed he would kick me off at the next stop. My mouth was suddenly dry, my stomach churning. Embarrassed and stammering, I stood again and started to explain that I had been away. I was a sophomore at a boarding school in New England and did not know the fare had changed. He looked me over with the sure gaze of a man who had heard every excuse and was practiced in sizing up passengers. He turned his eyes back to the road. His expression abruptly softened. "It's okay," he said. "Just pass it on. Pass it on." I thanked him and sat back down heavily, overwhelmed. Expecting humiliation, I instead received a simple act of grace. And for whatever reason, perhaps just the kindness in the face of certain reprimand, that moment left a lasting impression. It was a reminder that I should do for others what he had done for me.
Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick reading from his book, A Reason to Believe. I wanted you to read that because I found myself, as I began the book, wondering about the contrast between that black bus driver and the white students at Milton who perhaps had a different attitude.
Well, you know, I found relationships, many of them lifelong relationships and meaningful ones at Milton too. But it was quite a transition. You know, I arrived at Milton the night before classes began when I was 14 years old in 1970. I had never seen a place like it before. They had I was by myself. They had a dress code in those days. The boys wore jackets and ties to classes. So when the clothing list arrived at home, my grandparents splurged on a new jacket for me. But a jacket on the south side of Chicago is a windbreaker. So the first day of class, when all the other boys are putting on their blue blazers and their tweed coats, I had my windbreaker. So there, you know, that was...
When you walked in with your windbreaker?
Well, you know, you're standing there in the dorm dressing with the other 14-year-old boys, and they've got their ties and their blazers, and I had my tie from the Easter before and my new windbreaker. And it was clear that, you know, I hadn't quite cracked the code. But there were teachers and other adults at Milton who were open to me and reached out to me. There were kids I formed a bond with in time. It wasn't easy. I mean, one of the real challenges in that experience was the way in each environment, you know, each environment made you feel like you had to reject the other as the price of admission. So it was impossible to describe Milton in ways at home that people would understand and appreciate. It was impossible and uncomfortable to describe the south side of Chicago to my friends and my new world at Milton. And what I came to understand over time, and I write about this in the book, is that though you feel at the time you must make that choice, it's a false choice. If you really want to live as a citizen of the whole world, as I did, then the question is, how do you find your own true north and keep that authenticity no matter what setting you are in? And I had some wonderful folks who helped me understand that, and as I say, I write about that in the book.
How many other African-American students were there?
Not many, Diane, not many.
How many?
Oh, gracious, I think there might have been, it was a small class, but in a class of maybe 200 boys, there were, I don't know, maybe 15 black students.
And did you bond with them?
I did. You know, we were not all from the same place or the same circumstances, but it was a very tight group in many ways. In some ways, I will say, it was so tight it was hard to experience the rest of Milton, and I was determined to experience the rest of Milton, so there were tensions even there. But we worked that out, you know, and kids do.
Where was your father in all of this?
Well, my parents split, as I write in the book, when I was 4 years old. And I didn't know him very well when I was growing up. He's a jazz musician. He was one of the founding members of an avant-garde jazz group called Sun Ra. And he moved to New York when I'd say it was about 1960. I saw more of him when I came to Milton Academy because he was closer geographically, but he was very disapproving of Milton. He
really?
Thought, oh yes, he
really?
Thought he thought Milton would, leave me not black enough. That it was denying my own experience as a black kid, and he was very militant and very distrustful of the environment I was in. And I think, you know, as I came to know him later, I think he was just worried I was going to let my guard down and be hurt. But we had a very tortured relationship for many of these years. We had a reconciliation in time.
You know, I think about many children of immigrants mm-hmm. who come to this country, and I myself mm-hmm. am one who live in two worlds mm-hmm. that way, and whose parents are so distrustful mm-hmm. of the other mm-hmm. that it can make life very difficult for the child.
It's a challenge.
A challenge mm-hmm. if the child wants to try to live
right.
in both worlds.
Right, right. And I've seen this and experienced it, as I said, but, you know, I think that what I learned is that I could be the bridge, that I didn't have to choose one place or another. I had to decide who I was and be that all the time, everywhere. And I think one of the reasons I came to that, Diane, which I try to get at in the book, is that I wanted to live and be a part of lots of communities. I wanted to understand and be a citizen of the world. And that didn't start in Milton, by the way. That started back on the south side of Chicago. Mm-hmm. I had this extraordinary sixth grade teacher named Mrs. Quaintance. 40 of us in the class. We were a mess. You know, our home lives were a mess. The neighborhood was a mess. The mm-hmm. school in some ways was a mess. But she taught us to count and say the greetings in German. She took us to the first opera I'd ever seen. I was telling an audience this morning that I didn't know what they were singing about. I still don't know what they're singing about, but I loved it then, and I love it now.
You love opera.
She took us to see a new movie that was out called The Sound of Music, and she used it to teach us about the rise of the Nazis and the Second World War. She encouraged us to imagine ourselves as citizens of the whole world, and that was an incredible gift, that it was possible for us on the south side of Chicago to expand to any lengths we wanted to. And I tell you, that that kind of idealism sounds corny in today's environment of constant no and negativism, but it is transformative. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is because I think it's within the power of any of us to pass on that kind of idealism to another.
And certainly within the power of those elementary school teachers to create the prospect, the possibility of that dream.
Most especially.
For right. everyone. What would have happened if you had stayed on the south side of Chicago?
Who knows? But I will tell you, I'm asked that question by people who presume that but for Milton Academy, I'd still be on the south side, you know, gangbanging or something like that. I just don't think that's so. I'm grateful to A Better Chance. I've dedicated a portion of the proceeds of this book to A Better Chance, which made it possible for me to go to Milton Academy. I love Milton. It was an important part of my experience. But those middle-class aspirations and that willingness to dream big, that came before Milton.
Everything came before Milton that had to do with family, mm. that had to do with discipline somehow, some way, mm-hmm. with the adults in your life. Mm-hmm. And that's what seems to me so sad today, mm. that there are too few adults in young people's lives mm. willing to say, look, you have choices. Mm-hmm. You can make these choices. Mm-hmm. You can do this. You can do this. Mm-hmm. There's a fair amount of putting down those dreams instead of lifting them up.
I worry about that as a governor, as a citizen, as a parent. You know, the adults I recall and the ones I revere from my childhood and today are the ones who see their stake in all children, who don't limit themselves to, you know, the ones who do the small things in addition to the encouraging of that young person to dream big. Sometimes it's just correcting them in a loving way. There's a story here that I write about that an old and dear friend of mine who's since passed away, a former law partner who became a federal judge, told about growing up in poverty in Birmingham, Alabama in the 50s and 60s, and he had an opportunity to go to Morehouse College. And he talks about, he told me the story about going to Morehouse, and they had this marvelous freshman dinner, very formal, that the president, the legendary Dr. Benjamin Mays, and Mrs. Mays gave for the new students. And he said they were served T-bone steak. And he talked about how, and I write in the book about how he was loving the steak, which he had rarely, if ever, had. And then he got down to the bone, and as he described it, he picked it up and commenced to gnaw at it. And Mrs. Mays, who was a Victorian, an upright Victorian force in her own right, was sitting by him, he described, and she simply slid her plate across to him and said, "Take mine, son." And he was astute enough to know she was trying to teach him something without humiliating him. Just to get a coin, you know, so sometimes when you say to the, you know, I meet young people in schools. I try to visit a school once a week. Sometimes when I go into the into a junior high or a high school when the kids are cocky and feeling their oats, some of them will say, "Hey, Duvall," you know, and I appreciate that they feel familiar enough.
Yeah.
But I say to them, "It's Governor Patrick." And it's not a put-down. It is because someone needs to teach them some of those basic rules. Pull up your pants. Pull up your pants. Tuck in your shirt. I know this is old-fashioned stuff, but some of these basic lessons passed on in a loving way and with grace help.
Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, his new memoir is titled A Reason to Believe. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. You experienced a certain racial intolerance in Massachusetts. You decided not to return to Chicago. What happened when you got to Massachusetts?
You mean when
another kind of sort of thinking that goes on in one state as opposed to another?
Well, this is, Massachusetts is different today, but in the days when I got there in the early 70s, Boston in particular was struggling with the busing question. And there was a lot of hostility and a lot of, and some violence associated with that. And while Milton Academy itself was its own kind of cocoon, if you will, not immune, but isolated to some extent from all that. We were right on the edge of Boston, and go in, and every once in a while, someone shout a name or what have you. And I can remember one time going on a burger run late night with one of the house masters to collect Big Macs from the local McDonald's in Dorchester across the city line. And to bring them back to the dorm, and there was a really ugly scene in the parking lot with a bunch of kids who were shouting racial epithets, and one or two tried to toss their cigarette butts into my big afro at the time, banging on the plate glass windows of the McDonald's while we were collecting the food, and it was a scary thing. It was as upsetting in some ways for the faculty member as it was for me, because he had no capacity to explain it, to comfort me, or, you know, it was as embarrassing for him as well. Now, Massachusetts is not the same place today. But we struggled then with issues of race, and in this country we have struggled with issues of race. And we still struggle in the sense that we don't quite know how to both acknowledge the incredible progress we've made, much of it in my lifetime, and also the challenges that are in front of us. It's like you got to choose either, you know, the issue is gone or the issue is unchanged. Well, it's crazy to say that the issue is unchanged, you know. I mean, I'm governor of the Commonwealth, for goodness sake. But it's also wrong to say that we are done. Civil rights, in particular, as one friend once described it, as a relay race for justice, and every generation must do what they can to advance the baton and then hand it on to the next generation.
Are the birthers acting out of racial intolerance?
They seem to be acting out of insanity. I mean, I hate to sound disrespectful of anyone, but for goodness sake, the man's mother is a U.S. citizen, was a U.S. Citizen. He was born in this country, has a U.S. passport. You got to prove that you're a citizen in order to get the passport. Let's move on.
Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, his new book, A Reason to Believe.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Manta, an online destination for small businesses to be found and to find new customers. Learn more at manta.com. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help families earn it, keep it, save it during Financial Literacy Month, on the web at aecf.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Michelle Williams. She co-starred in the teen TV series Dawson's Creek, but headed in a more challenging direction in her movies Blue Valentine, Wendy and Lucy, Brokeback Mountain, and the new film Meek's Cutoff. The turning point of her career?
I was offered this play called Killer Joe, and I was also offered a movie about cheerleaders who carry guns.
Join us.
And we're back with Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, who has a brand new memoir out. It's titled A Reason to Believe, Lessons from an Improbable Life. Here's an email. Actually, this was posted on the DR Show website. It says, given the education you had at Milton and the independent schools, do you support vouchers so that more Massachusetts families can choose the right school for their children, including independent schools?
It's a great question. I support choice, but I draw the line at vouchers because I think it's a hollow offering. There's no voucher that's going to pay for the tuition at Milton Academy. And, you know, what we have to acknowledge is that most kids are going to get their education in the traditional district schools. And the question is, how do we get them to sing? We did a bill last year. Our kids... I will say that in the coming on 5 years I've been in office, we have funded public education at the highest level in the history of the Commonwealth, even when the bottom was falling out of the rest of the state budget. We did that because I believe from my own experience and as a policymaker that there is no better form of long-term investment in our collective future. We have doubled the charter cap. We have also created many, many more ways to have flexibility in the traditional schools. We call them innovation schools, so that we can try the kinds of things that meet kids where they are. Our students have performed at the top of the nation in student achievement in each of the last 5 years, but we have also had for many, many years a persistent achievement gap, and the kids who are stuck in that gap are poor or speak English as a second language or have special needs. And, you know, it's an educational and economic issue to have an achievement gap at all, but to let it go as long as it has gone in Massachusetts, almost 2 decades now, that's a moral question. Now we have some tools to be able to reach that part of our Commonwealth-wide family.
All right, let's open the phones to Brighton, Massachusetts.
Brighton.
Good morning, DB. You're on the air.
Hi, DB.
Hey, good morning, Governor.
Good morning.
Here's my question. You know, in an age of such horrible negative campaigning, and with 2 really negative campaigns against you, you ran 2 positive campaigns in 1. What on earth were you thinking?
Well, DB, I was thinking I should be myself no matter what. You know, that I should run willing to lose because, number one, I think people read a fraud every time. They know when you're making it up. Secondly, I'm not a negative person by nature. I think you need to know what we're for, not just what we're against. And I, for one, am tired of all the negativity. I think that helps explain why there's so little participation in our politics and in our civic life. And I think if we want people to come back in, we got to give them something to feel positive about. And we are a positive nation by character. It's had a whole lot to do with the kinds of things we've been able to accomplish in the Commonwealth and in the country as a whole. So I'm just trying to reflect that back.
Let's take a call here in D.C. Good morning, Eric. You're on the air.
Good morning, Eric.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Governor. Thanks so much for taking my call. Governor,
sure.
2 quick questions, and if you might comment on them, I'd appreciate that. You yourself, Governor, the president, and the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, are distinct as far as African-American leadership is concerned. You're a totally new breed, very forceful, and don't have the pedigree of the civil rights movement to distinguish yourself. You just happen to be national leaders who are black. And I would like the governor to comment on this. Is this a trend? Is it something that we think is going to happen and its influence on it? Then the second part of my question, Governor, is a few years ago during the campaign, the president was accused of plagiarism, and I was watching you with great anticipation, hoping you'd come out and very forcefully dispense of the idea that he had borrowed the words from you without your permission. Thanks, Governor. I'll take my response off the phone.
Thank you, Eric. Well, first of all, in terms of the question whether we are a new breed of black leaders, I don't know. I mean, I started my career as a lawyer, as a civil rights lawyer at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. I was the head of the Civil Rights Division in the Clinton administration, and I can tell you that both Mayor Booker and President Obama understand that we have the positions we have because we're standing on the shoulders of people who did that worthy work over a generation or more. I think on the question of the so-called plagiarism, it still makes me smile because I remember sitting with then-Senator Obama the summer before the election really heated up. He was in it, but it was the summer before the year of voting. So that would have been, 2007? And, you know, I don't pretend to be an expert in politics. I've only run 2 times, but I said, Mr. President, I have 3 pieces of advice for you. Not Mr. President, excuse me, Senator. I have 3 pieces of advice for you. And one of them was to prepare for the folks who would say to him, as they did to me when I was running, that it was just words. It was all about the rhetoric and not about the substance. And I said, you know what, don't yield on that point. Come back, and here's what I said, and you should use it. And they did just that, and he used what I offered him when in response, and I was proud he did.
And that's exactly what Congressman Paul Ryan is saying today. He says we have to stop rewarding politicians who make empty promises to the voters. We don't need a campaigner in chief right now. What do you say to Paul Ryan?
You know, you can imagine Paul Ryan at the time of the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. I suppose Paul Ryan would say, "Well, that's just empty rhetoric. That doesn't actually set out a vision of what it is we are trying to accomplish here." What the president understands is that the budget is not a math problem. It's about people. It's about the choices we make about the kind of country we want to live in. And that is exactly where the debate ought to be.
But
because
you know,
that has real implications for policy, and that is the level at which I think we as citizens can engage.
You know, it's as though corporations have taken on that same mantra, however, that we are responsible to our shareholders. They're the ones who are important rather than the integrity of the product we're putting out there.
Well, I think in the case of government, we are above all responsible to our to the people, but not just at election time, meaning not just to appeal to them for their support, but to help them help themselves. This is the difference, I think, one difference between the modern Republican Party, at least as I experience it, and at the national level, and what Democrats believe. We don't believe that government is about solving every problem in everybody's life, but it is about helping people help themselves. And I think that the modern Republican Party seems to be about the notion that everyone's on their own and good luck.
Here's an email from Terry in Davenport, Iowa, who says, as a retired school counselor out here in Iowa, your ideas on positive encouragement of young people seem so valuable and on the money. What do you recommend that a white man in my situation do to help counter racism and other factors adverse to the advancement of young people of all color?
Wow. Well, Terry, first of all, I think that as someone who has been in education, again, I can't think of any more high impact profession than what happens when a highly motivated, well supported teacher is in front of those children, loving them, because they, you know, and raising their expectations of themselves. That's the kind of education I got from the teachers I write about in this book, and I think that has absolutely nothing to do with race. I got that from black teachers and white teachers and young teachers and old teachers. I didn't get it in every single class, but I got it in a lot of classes. And I will say, this is a field of the question. I've kept up with those teachers. You know, my third grade teacher was present when I was inaugurated. My sixth grade teacher, who since passed away, was present when I was when I graduated from college and law school, when I was married, when I was sworn in to the Justice Department position I had. I've kept up with the eighth grade teacher who introduced me to A Better Chance, and that ninth grade teacher at Milton Academy, who had such an impact on me in so many ways, is somebody I think about every single day.
You and your wife, Diane,
yes,
were married in 1984.
Right.
Would you read for us from page 187, starting with reading the paper?
Sure. Let me set it up, Diane. My wife Diane is an extraordinary woman, a lawyer and a partner in a law firm in Boston. We've been married for over 25 years now. I should have calculated. I'm sorry, Diane. I should have calculated that before I started down that path. We have two grown-up daughters who are as remarkable as their mother. She is incredibly effective publicly, but she is a very private person by nature. And so I want to read about what the impact of the early days in office was like for her. Reading the paper, she told me one day, makes me nervous and weak. It feels like kryptonite. Then stop reading the newspaper, I said. Do you think Superman seeks out kryptonite? I thought it was that simple. I had been consumed with the campaign and then with the immediate demands of my new job. I knew that expectations were high, that I would be held to a different standard, and I was eager to serve with class, thoughtfulness, and professionalism. So I was busy poring over resumes to find outstanding appointees for the cabinet and trying to understand the intricacies of the state budget. I was conscientious about serving the people of Massachusetts, but I did not serve the most important person in my life. I didn't realize how badly Diane was hurting. When our official photograph was taken as governor and first lady of Massachusetts, she wore a radiant red jacket but could barely muster a smile. She felt that she had lost control over her life and was spiraling into depression.
And then what happened?
Well, we had a an episode where she was really in such a panic, Diane. She couldn't even think about getting out of bed. And we were in touch with a therapist she had seen some years before, and the therapist admitted her to the hospital. And there was a really scary period where she, I think as people do when they are seriously depressed, wonder whether they will ever feel better again. With some great counseling and a lot of love and some great help at the hospital, she turned the corner pretty quickly. But we had some really heart-to-heart conversations about whether this life that I had thrust us into was worth it.
Did you think about resigning?
I did. We talked about it directly. You know, sometimes she would say, I want you to leave this job. I don't want to do this anymore. And then I'd say, well, let's talk about that when you feel better. And then there are other days when, you know, this is all over the span of about 2 or 3 weeks or less. And I'd say, if this is what it takes for you to feel better, that's what I will do. And she would say, no, let's think about it later and so on. I know we are both delighted, first and foremost, that she is great and feels better and is back to work and is herself and has understood now how to do as much of the First Lady stuff as she wants to and not anymore. She has talked about this publicly, and it has saved thousands of lives. So you would just be amazed at the incredible messages and of encouragement and prayers and gratitude that she gets from people all over the Commonwealth. And and it was she, you know, we had to have the conversation or have a conversation when it was time for re-election. You know, do you want to do this again? And it was she who said, finish what you started. And we ran, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I think we have time for one last call in Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Sam.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Sam.
I want to comment about medical costs in the U.S. It's a little off topic, but I think my comment is important. And I want to say that I'm from India, and I feel like we are overtraining doctors in the U.S. The time it takes to train a doctor in the U.S. is very long. Hello?
Are you a medical student, Sam, by any chance?
No, I'm working on my PhD in engineering, but around 10% of doctors in the U.S. are from India. And in India, they start early. They start in high school.
Mm-hmm.
You can choose medical field or engineering field.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You can either drop the biology classes or the math classes.
Mm-hmm.
And then it takes 5 years to earn your MBBS, which is bachelor's in medicine and surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And that reduces the time, and you can train a lot more people faster.
What do you think?
I don't know if I have an opinion about that. You know, I know that in India, as in other places, the time for choosing your future career is imposed on young people sooner than it is here. And we allow young people to, through our educational system, to think about those choices for longer periods of time and keep their options open. We're also the most innovative nation on earth, so I think that's probably connected to those choices as well. So I'm not sure I have an opinion, Sam. I know we got to get the cost of health care down, and we are working hard on that in Massachusetts and making some great progress, which I think we can model for the rest of the country.
Finally, an awful lot of people want to know, as does John, in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, are there any future circumstances under which Governor Deval Patrick could see himself running for president?
Oh, gracious. I see our time is up. I'm going to finish this term, Diane, and go back into private life, and I'll look forward to that. And if there's something, some way in which I can contribute and feel I have something to contribute in the future, then that'll be in the future.
The book is titled A Reason to Believe, Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. What a pleasure to see you again.
It's wonderful to see you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.